because it's so foundational to our lives, so we don't really notice how much Greek thinking, like, just blankets all of our thought. So Greek thinking, we're going to have three pages of this. In Greek thinking, it values form, appearance, observable, measurable, physical reality, and it believes that knowledge is the ultimate pursuit and that knowledge is discoverable. So think about what you know about Greek thinking. Can you see that? Think of the statues and the beauty. Think of the ideas that they focus on of liberty and truth and democracy and, you know, just so many ideas that are the pinnacle of Greek thought. In contrast, Hebrew thinking values function, relationship with God, and believes that knowledge must be revealed. So here are some differences. In Greek thought, life is analyzed in precise categories versus in Hebrew, everything blurs into everything else. So one way you can think about that is just in language. In Hebrew language, it's more like a word cloud instead of a definition. So if you say, like, water in Hebrew, it would bring to mind this whole word cloud of women and life and cleansing and redemption and resurrection and baptism and miracles, and like all of that would come all at the same time when you said the word water. Versus in English, or, you know, in Greek thought, if we said water, it would be really specific. Like, are we talking about water we're drinking? Are we talking about water in the desert? Are we, you know, like, it would, we could really zone in and have it be specific. There's a split between natural and supernatural versus in Hebrew, the supernatural affects everything. Linear logic versus contextual logic. Rugged individualism versus in Hebrew, the importance of being part of a group, being part of a tribe, a family. Equality of persons versus value from place and hierarchies. Freedom orientation versus security orientation. In the Greek, competition is good. In Hebrew, cooperation is better. A man-centered universe versus a God, tribe, or family-centered universe. Worth of a person based on money, material, possessions, or power. We can really see that, right, in our culture for sure. Versus worth derived from family relationships. Think of the Old Testament and how many times we get these lineages of family relationships. Like, that's actually what defines a person versus how rich they are. Biological life is sacred versus social life is supremely important. Chance and cause and effect limit what can happen versus God causes everything in his universe. Here are some more. An interesting one is change is good and equals progress versus change is bad and is a destruction of tradition in the Hebrew. Universe evolved by chance versus universe created by God. Universe dominated and controlled by science and technology versus God gave man stewardship over his earthly creation and we are accountable to him. And then so the last ones, that top one we kind of visited before with the wealth aspect, but material goods are a measure of personal achievement versus a measure of God's blessing. In Greek, they would view faith as blind, and in Hebrew, they would view it as knowledge-based. Time is a straight line, like it's very linear, versus time is determined by content. By content in the day that the Lord did this. So this day is important because the Lord did something on that day versus it's March 3rd. What things look like versus what things are. Intellectual virtues are the substance and meaning of life versus moral virtues are the substance and meaning of life. Right thinking versus right conduct. And what do I do or think or believe versus how do I? So it's all about behavior and function and relationship instead of about nailing what is right in that moment. All right. So Greek thought is very much idea truth, which is abstract, universal, unchangeable, passive, and discoverable. Versus in Hebrew, it's person truth, which is concrete and particular, contextual, a moral agent, active, and must be revealed. So these differences are illustrated by the very different ways the two cultures welcome babies. In a Greek-based culture such as ours, when Aunt Bertha is called about a new baby in the family, what is she going to ask?
What is it? What it weigh?
What did it weigh? Yep. How long is it? How long was labor? Maybe the color of the hair, color of the eyes. In a Hebrew culture, those questions would be very different. Aunt Bertha would ask, what message is he or she bringing from God? What does his or her spirit tell you? What feeling do you get when you hold him or her? Asking about appearance or physical data would not make any sense to someone in a Hebrew culture because those aspects of a person are not what make the person. How much someone weighs when they are born is irrelevant to who they are. On top of that, it is an incredibly fleeting measure because the moment they nurse or poop, it's going to change. So it has, like, they wouldn't even understand that at all. Most of my talk is based on this book called Who is Truth? And I'll have lots of quotes from here. Highly recommend it. Jeffrey Thain and Edwin Gant. They start chapter one by saying, for centuries, philosophers have wrestled with the question, what is truth? That question presumes that truth is a what. In the Greek perspective, we can know we have truth when we have the right set of ideas about the world. Those right ideas are those that do not change when we have new experiences. In other words, truth describes the universal, unchanging order of things. Greek thinking views truth as an idea, and a true idea is abstract, universal, unchangeable, passive, and discoverable. But in contrast, Hebrew thinking views truth as a person, the person of God, and that person is concrete and particular, contingency is active, and must be revealed. God must reveal himself to us. In Greek thinking, things that are unchangeable trump things that can change. So they have more value if they're unchangeable. Abstract ideas trump concrete realities. In John 14:6, it says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. In John 1:1, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In John 1:14, the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. In Alma 38:9, behold, he is the Word of truth and righteousness. And Ezra Taft Benson said, let us never fear truth, but only its misuse. On the contrary, let us love truth above all else, for God himself is truth. Richard M. Williams, a psychologist, said, the truth, the word, the understanding, the message from God comes to us not as a set of ideas, but as a person. The authors propose that one major consequence of the Greek influence on Christian thought was the replacement of a dynamic, agentic, relational God with an abstract, unembodied, timeless, formless, unchanging being. For example, the Westminster Confessional states, there is but one living and true God who is infinite in being and perfection, a most pure spirit, invisible, without body, parts, or passions. This next quote is kind of long. This is by Dallin H. Oakes. The collision between the speculative world of Greek philosophy and the simple, literal faith and practice of the earliest Christians produced sharp contentions that threatened to widen political divisions in the fragmenting Roman Empire. This led Emperor Constantine to convene the first churchwide council in AD 325. The action of this Council of Nicaea remains the most important single event after the death of the apostles in formulating the modern Christian concept of deity. Other councils followed, and from their decisions and the writings of churchmen and philosophers, there came a synthesis of Greek philosophy and Christian doctrine, in which the tangible personal God described in the Old and New Testament was replaced by an abstract, incomprehensible being that was defined by compromise with the speculative principles of Greek philosophy. The received language of the Bible remained, but the so-called hidden meanings of scriptural words were now explained in the vocabulary of a Greek philosophy alien to their origins. In the language of that philosophy, God the Father ceased to be a father in any but an allegorical sense. He ceased to exist as a comprehensible and compassionate being, and the separate identity of his only begotten Son was swallowed up in a philosophical abstraction that attempted to define a common substance and an incomprehensible relationship. I know that was a long quote, but I want you to think about that. What stood out to you in that idea? Can you see how this process happened? That the church was living in a Greek world with all sorts of Greek ideas, and they're trying to come together and define who God is, but they're doing it from a Greek perspective instead of from the Hebrew perspective that the Old Testament was written in. And like, it had to just be, you know, I can just picture like these fights and these discussions, and then they're like, okay, we'll come up with this synthesis of ideas, but it wasn't actually based on truth.
It felt like sterilization of God, mm-hmm. like separating us from him. It was like this, that's just not.
Yeah, saying. Yeah, for sure. Anybody else have a thought on that process of how Greek ideas infiltrated Hebrew thought?
It almost seems like in homeschooling, we're trying to get back to the Hebrew way where you're like family and what can we do and like your value is not, like some people like myself, I'm not real big on grades unless you're trying to do a high school transcript. So it doesn't matter how you're measured, let's just keep working on it.
Right.
So if you, you know.
Yeah. For
I've
sure.
Never known that and separated that out.
Yeah, our souls, I think, feel torn regularly because we're living in a Greek world, but so much of the things we know and we believe are rooted in a Hebrew perspective, and they just don't mesh. And it's not just religion, right? I mean, it's like everywhere. I mean, just think about the baby being born, you know, like like just a simple thing like that. So is it any wonder that some of us struggle with developing a relationship with Jesus Christ? Because it's the definitions we're given about him aren't necessarily rooted in how our soul receives him and how it feels. So in the Greek, Aesop's fables represent universal maxims, right? Like think of how Aesop's fables are taught. Like this is a true idea, right? Slow and steady wins the race. Prepare now, for the winter is coming. Like, there's so many. And those are, like, seen as absolute truths. And there's nothing wrong with those messages, but it's not the full idea. Versus the Hebrew conception proposes that what something does defines what it is. In the Hebrew, truth is experienced as a lived relationship. There is no search for truth that is distinct from the search of communion with a living, loving God. In the Hebrew, God changes the world. So it's not unchangeable, right? God changes the world. In the Hebrew, right behavior is based on covenantal commitments. In the Hebrew, Jesus' parables are narratives to be lived and relived within changing contexts that bring forth new and deeper meanings and possibilities. So, I know that was a lot to process, but why does any of this matter? Why do these two different perspectives matter? Why do you understand them? It matters for three reasons, and probably lots more, but these were three that I think are the most important. One is covenant relationship. Two is different questions lead to different answers. And three, our world is full of a plethora of information. And so how do we sort out what the right information is, what the right truth is, if we're looking at it from a Greek perspective? So in this covenant relationship, I want you to imagine that you are in a relationship with someone that you don't really know who they are, and you don't know what their role in the relationship is. How would that feel?
Totally disconnected.
Yeah, it would feel so weird. Like, even if you're just, like, in a business relationship with them, and you're like, I don't actually know who this person is or why they're in this relationship, but I'm just working my butt off, trying to, you know, make it work, but I'm not really sure what the other person's, why are they here? I don't know. So let's talk about the prodigal son story. Perhaps both sons viewed their father incorrectly. Maybe they viewed him as the bestower of inheritance and praise, and an inculcator of moral character. Those are some good things to be as a father, right? And maybe they viewed him that way. So when the younger son received his inheritance and behaved in ways not deserving of praise and demonstrated a complete lack of moral character, he felt he could not go to his father. Now the older son, at least in his mind, deserved the inheritance and the praise, and was the embodiment of moral character. So he deserved everything. And he felt angry and betrayed when his father showered his younger, supposedly undeserving brother with love. But neither brother really knew who their father was or what his role in the relationship was. Now imagine if both sons knew that their father was 100% committed to the redemption of each of his children, and that he was going to do everything he could possibly do to help each child individually grow in his love. How would that change the story if that's how the brothers viewed their father?
I think, I don't know that it would change things for the rebellious one, right? Like, I think he probably would have still done what he did, you know? But I think it would have changed things a lot for the other brother to realize that's what his father's, to know right from the beginning that's what his father's intent was, instead of thinking that he doled out things based on what you did.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
I think it would have changed the rebellious one, and he put off coming back to his father so long. He was taking care of those pigs, and they were eating better than he was. And I think that if he had felt that love, that his father wanted what was best for him, he would have come back sooner.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting, when he came back, he didn't come back asking to be a member of the household. He came back asking to be a day laborer, which is someone that the landowner does not have responsibility for. You're just hired for the day, so you're not part of the family. That's what he was begging to do. So even when he decides to come back, he doesn't say, please, I'm your son, take me back. He's like, let me just be a day laborer and work on your farm for food, you know. Like, he still doesn't know that his father absolutely loves him and wants him back.
I think maybe the prodigal son wouldn't have even left in the first place, because he would have seen his father not just as, like, the barrier, like, the gate to open whether or not I would get, you know, am I going to get my inheritance?
Right.
There would be more relationship there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas he's just like, I need you for the money, give me the money now, and then he leaves.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So, can you think of a time when you have come face to face with God's heart? I need a picture. Did you struggle to put that experience into words because of our culture's foundation of a Greek perspective? I want you to go through that coming face to face with God's heart and see if you can approach it with a Hebrew lens. And see if it becomes easier to describe. Anybody want to share, have a thought? That mindset shift change anything for you? Lynn?
Well, I think from a spiritual perspective, we think Greek. No.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrew. We think Hebrew spiritually mostly because as you have a relationship with God that is very person
right.
oriented. It's not abstract at all. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's totally different because you know. I mean, it's
right. But then sometimes it's hard to describe, right? Because our language is Greek-based. Like, we just don't...
There's a feel.
Yeah.
It's a lot of feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
I think it's helpful to have that perspective that if I share what God did for me, or that would be enough for a person from a Hebrew perspective to understand something about him. I don't have to say, like, this is the way he is. I need to share my experiences. Mm-hmm. What I saw him do with that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very experiential for sure. And in it's definitely like outcome based, right? And so sometimes we have a relationship with God and the outcome doesn't actually turn out in this way that we can like say, look, like here is what he did, and it's so, you know, obvious, and we can, you know, like put it up on the wall and be like, this is what happened because of God's relationship with me. Sometimes like the outcome is kind of yucky, but we still feel loved and comforted and held, and so we don't really necessarily have like a framework to describe that. It feels kind of yucky. Like we want to be able to like say, no, look.
The way that you just explained it is kind of how I felt. Like when, a few years ago, my little brother was killed in a car accident, and he's a believer, and our family is believers, and I experienced a different side of God in like a much deeper way that is really hard to put into words, but it is kind of like how you just said, like I almost like wanted to find like the reason for it. Like, well, God had this plan for it and this is why it happened, and there might not necessarily be a reason. Like sometimes things just happen and he is still good even though bad things happen, and it's like I saw a different side of his face through that tragedy, and it is hard to explain, but
yeah,
I almost had like a deeper connection with the Lord through that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for sharing. All right, the second reason is that if we ask different questions, we get different answers, right? Hebrew thought may appear irrational from the perspective of Greek philosophy, and the person view of truth may look bizarre to those acculturated into an idea view of truth. This is why many of the questions we ask, however simple and honest they may seem, simply do not have immediate answers. It is because our questions implicitly assume a Greek worldview, and we are dealing with a Hebrew faith. The idea view of truth and its Greek assumptions has made Hebrew tradition and belief look like nonsense. However, these same beliefs and practices make perfect sense if we see the world through a Hebrew lens and adopt a person view of truth. When we know the difference between Greek and Hebrew thought, we can develop a richer understanding of our beliefs. So these are some different questions. So the top one is going to be the Greek perspective. What abstract rules do I need to live by to be a good person? And maybe none of us have actually said that, like, with that language and said abstract rules, but we've all asked that question, right? What are the rules? What do I need to do to live a good life, right? Versus, how can I carry the Holy Spirit with me into every context to help enact God's will for me in my day-to-day life? Can you feel the difference in that question? What are the rules I need to follow versus how can I carry the Spirit with me? How can I better understand and implement the atonement in my daily life? I'm sure we've all asked that, right? I know I have. Versus, how can I more fully submit to Christ's will and accept his invitation to be at one with him and our Heavenly Father? There's a richness there, right? Which should we trust more, reason or revelation? I've asked that. Like, I can reason something out forever on the hamster wheel of my mind, you know, going around and around and around. Versus, how can we use the divine gift of reason to articulate and defend our loyalties to God? So instead of putting it an either or like fight, how can we utilize the minds that God has given us? If I truly believe in God and strive to live the gospel with exactness, why don't I always get the blessings I expect or that were promised? I've asked that.
Because we don't believe.
Mm.
We don't believe it'll happen. We don't have the faith. And we've already defeated or been defeated.
Versus, how can my hardships draw me closer to God and serve as a witness of His divine hand in my life? Which I think kind of applies to your situation, right? How can I use this horrible tragedy to draw me closer to God? How can I give Him my heart more fully? I want you to think about Paul and Esther and Simon Peter. What kind of questions do you think they asked? Their stories are all very different, and yet they're all similar. They all needed to know who God was and what He was wanting them to do. I mean, Paul was spending his time persecuting the Christians, right? And he had an experience with God, with a person God, right? That brought him face to face, not an idea God, but a person God that helped him to completely change his life and become a new person. So he was no longer identified as Saul, the persecutor of the Christians. Instead, he was Paul, the great, you know, trumpet of God. We have Esther, who logically it would have made sense to never enter the king's quarters, right? But instead, she trusted that feeling in her heart. She trusted that she had a role to play in saving her people. And Peter, and he needed to know that Jesus had him, and that wasn't going to just be with an idea. He really needed to know that he was in God's keeping. The person truth perspective truly is the perspective of the original church. The challenges come when we are living in a world saturated with the Greek idea perspective. Our third one is that our world is full of a plethora of information. So if we're going to make decisions based on this idea view of truth, then we're always going to be searching for the right information, right? There's a hierarchy of ideas. So if we find one set of ideas that seems true, there's always going to be more above that, right? Like there's this endless search for information, for truth, because until we reach the most abstract and the most unchangeable, then we haven't really reached the full idea of truth. So it breeds in us this desire to search and search and search and search and search instead of rest in God's ways. And there's nothing wrong with research or study, right? Nothing at all. But if our motive is not one of receiving what God has for us and is instead always assuming that there's bigger truth or better truth out there, then it's really hard for our soul to be at peace. Can you see that in your life? Especially now with all of the, we have the internet in our pocket at all hours of the day. And now with AI and crazy AI videos and photos, like we have no idea what the real truth is. So we could spend tons of time trying to figure out, like, is that picture real? Is this video real? Like, we don't know. And it's exhausting. I want you to think about a time where you have received revelation for your life. Maybe you have followed it. Maybe you got that revelation and you followed it. Maybe you didn't. Maybe you took it to the internet or to the people and you were researching and the logical thing seemed to say to not follow that revelation. Has anyone had that experience where you've made a decision based on logic and reason instead of what God put on your heart? I know I have, for sure. When we do that, we miss out on relationship with Jesus Christ. We miss out on following something that perhaps doesn't make sense logically. How does recognizing the differences between these two perspectives impact your life and your faith? I'll share a story, and then you can. I want you to think, and hopefully you'll have something to share about these two different perspectives. One of my biggest takeaways from my study of the Hebrew view and the Greek view has been a deepened hope in Jesus Christ's ability to redeem me. Not all the other people that I know he can redeem, but me, the person that I'm up close with every single day and see all of my flaws over and over and over again. In the Greek perspective, what is unchanging is the most valuable. So I want you to think about that with repentance. Okay? In the Greek perspective, a person's personality is seen as unchangeable. And so it's seen as who you are. How does that work with God working in your life? With repentance and redemption and change. In the Hebrew perspective, what a person does is the way a person is. It defines what it is. So if you are kind and loving and welcoming and generous in this moment, then that's who you are. If you change the next moment and you're mean and crass and all sorts of things, that's who you are. And you change back and you're kind and loving again, that's who you are from a Hebrew perspective. Think about that with repentance, with change, with God working in your life. Because so often we define ourselves in really unchangeable ways, right? But then it's hard. Like, God tells us he'll change us. But we're viewing ourselves as these unchangeable beings. In the Hebrew, who we are is defined by our ongoing activities and relationships, not by what is unchanging about us. Our core identity is not fixed in our personality. Instead, who we are is defined by what we do. So if we change what we do, we change who we are, literally. In Abraham 3:25, it says, "And we will prove them herewith to see if they will do all things whatsoever the Lord their God will command them." Now, how you interpret this verse depends on your lens, Hebrew versus Greek. If you think of your human identity as unchangeable and the test of life is to discover your inner nature and true identity, then the purpose of mortality is to put us in situations where our nature is made manifest in behavior, thought, word, and deed. From this perspective, if someone is resurrected into heaven, his or her choices were simply manifestations of a latent heavenly nature. This Greek-inspired perspective makes the idea of real, lasting change in the soul difficult to understand. Our desires and habits and inclinations and attitudes are seen as who we really are. But in the Hebrew perspective, if we see human nature as bound up in our actions, then we understand the judgment and the purpose of life quite differently. And so whether we are heavenly material or not is entirely up for revision at any time. We can change at any time. As moral agents, it is up to us in each moment whose voice we will list to obey and in whose image we seek to be remade. So how can you imagine that these two perspectives, understanding the differences of them, will impact your life?
Well, just on change alone, if you say, this is how I am,
yeah.
Well, you're done. But if you realize that you can change and become more,
right.
Then it opens up a whole new vista of life.
Right. You can make a different choice, yeah. And be a different person. Yeah.
that for me, it really changes my perspective on the Bible, because I feel like sometimes people can have questions or frustrations or confusion over, especially the Old Testament, right, about stories and ways things are said and different things like that. And I think it really helps, at least me, to remember that we're dealing with a completely different way of thinking, right? Mm-hmm. A different way of thinking, a different way of thought.
Yeah.
That it's not just ancient, like you have the ancient part on top of it, right? But then it's just a totally different mm-hmm. way of thinking about it, and that you can't look at those stories and you can't look at those historical events or whatever in the same lens that we would look at modern things or we're used to
right.
doing that. And I think that's a hard connection for some people that can make them feel, you know, frustrated. But I think it really helps if you keep that perspective of a different culture and a different thought and a different process mm-hmm. and being okay with that and understanding that and seeing it from that lens.
Right. Yeah.
Several years ago, I was really into the Myers-Briggs
right.
personality testing. Mm-hmm. And
ENFP, here I am.
So I was considered an INTP, and so there was a Facebook group of INTPs. I mean, everybody was welcome except for probably the there were ones we didn't like, but I'm not gonna say which ones they are. But anyway, you know, in a conversation group, I said, because I, for those unfamiliar, like the T part, like the INTP, you're either the thinker or you're a feeler. And you said you're an F?
Yep, ENFP.
So I, as a thinker, said, well, I feel this way. And, oh, boy, people came down. Like, they're like, you're a T. You don't feel, you think. And I'm like, I'm not allowed to feel? So that was
because
like,
I have a tendency to more often think through things than feel through things. That doesn't mean
like
feeling is off limits.
Yeah, exactly. And so that kind of gave me pause, and I'm like, well, if we're not allowed to, like, grow, like, basically, like, we're just shoved in this box mm-hmm. of this is what your personality is, and it will always be that way.
Right.
And that's a lot of these people in this group were just stuck in that box.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, like, I've kind of just dropped that whole way of thinking, because it does. It puts you in that box, and, like, you can't really get out of it
mm-hmm.
and not allowed to, like, change. And so since, like, kind of breaking out of that and it's like everybody can be kind of a blend of all of those things, and
mm-hmm.
that's kind of more, I guess, the Hebrew thinking is just
yeah.
trying to change and not get stuck in that box and just saying, well, that's it.
Right. Yeah. I love that. Any other thoughts?
It brings to mind, there's a book by Ruby Payne, it's called The Culture of Poverty, and when I was in grad school, we went through this, and it's fascinating. Regardless of how much money you have or don't have, or resources you have or don't have, there's a way of thinking that you
mm-hmm.
have. And so it's a tiny little book, you know, if you wanted to, you could fly through it, and gosh, if you're a fast reader, maybe half hour. But if you really take your time, then it had this whole, and it is a culture. And
mm-hmm.
so it was, you know, for example, what they found in lower, like in poverty cultures, is they tend to talk and speak. It's a little more like Hebrew in reference of events. Time
mm.
is circular, not linear. Things are family related, not individual related. All this kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
there's a very strong correlation.
Mm.
And then the higher up that you go, so there's basically like poverty, middle class, and the wealthy. They just broke it down into
mm-hmm.
these three. And again, it's not what you have right now, but it's how you think. So people who grew up in poverty, maybe now they're well off, but they have that line of thinking.
Right.
How do they share and access resources? And
mm-hmm.
poverty thinking, if I have something, I am expected to share it. What we have today may be gone tomorrow. All
mm-hmm.
this kind of stuff. Whereas middle and upper, it's like, well, you have to put some in savings.
Mm-hmm.
You have to think ahead. You have to plan. There's no planning at the lower level. It's more survival and sharing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this whole thing, and I was in
yeah.
the education system, and it's like, if you're talking to parents, and you're saying, let's plan for your child, blah, 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 and they're thinking, we're just trying to get through this week, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be successful communicating and helping your child to grow.
Right.
So that book was just phenomenal in terms of
mm-hmm.
the reference point.
Yeah.
But it did
can see some overlap.
Reflect more, yeah.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Anyone else? How does recognizing these differences impact your life or your faith?
I just sorry, my voice is gone. I keep thinking about the parable of the prodigal son, because that particular story has always like rubbed me wrong, and I'm like, I'm very Greek thinking about it, because I want justice for the older brother. And it's just been interesting if you've gone through this. Sorry, my voice is. I just think, man, we do, like, we're so Greek thinking and wanting justice, and thinking like we can even look at the father and be like, oh, he was so magnanimous. But I'm like, if you step back into the Hebrew perspective, like you're saying, it's more about like the son changed. Like, we should all be able to like accept whoever comes back with open arms. And that's such a difficult concept in the Greek thinking.
Yeah.
Like, it's so hard.
You messed up, so that's who you are.
Yeah, that's who
you are.
You're
a low-life scum who eats with pigs.
And I am better because I've been here the whole time. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And anyway, so it's just really interesting because I'm like, man, we're so entrenched in it that we don't, at least I am, like, I'm like, wow, I don't even realize how Greek I am.
Yeah.
But I also am, like, thinking about the father because I'm like, in the Hebrew perspective, that whole story is about the father and how the father can just accept and you know, bring them in and see them both for who they are. Mm-hmm. Not even the same, but for who they are, and he can love. And that's for us as well to see our fellow men and to be able to love at that capacity. And I'm just like, that's where I just keep circling in my mind.
I mean, I've been studying Hebrew for about 25 years, and when I read this book, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so Greek in my thinking. Like, I was like, I'm totally Hebrew in my thinking. Nope. Like, it's we're born into it. Like, it's the undergirdings of our entire civilization, and so we don't even know. We don't even recognize it. So my hope is, oh.
Can I just add one thing?
Yeah.
I think sometimes, like, in our scriptures, we hear about the angry God, and in Greek, like, I don't want him to be angry, but in the Hebrew, you know, language, he is loving and kind, and you have a covenant relationship with him, and he wants us back, and he's given us repentance. Like, those seem like this God that I want. I don't want the angry, the frustrated, the mad at me for doing something wrong God. Like, and that's kind of those two.
Yeah, for sure. So I hope that as you go forth in your life, that you will just start noticing, just observe when you find yourself in Greek thinking or in Hebrew thinking. And it's not that one is better than the other. Like, I'm not saying, like, down with Greek thinking. It has lots of value. I'm just saying, start noticing it and make a choice to be like, okay, put on my Hebrew lens. How would I view this if I had Hebrew eyes right now? How would I view it with Greek eyes? And just start noticing and deepening that awareness so that you can kind of make sense within your soul of the big feelings we have with interpersonal relationship with God and our Greek world. Like, it's so messy and hard to kind of integrate. But I think as you notice the differences, that it will become easier. You'll be able to make that shift.
I was going to say, too, though, I think it's also important to realize that, I mean, you can call it Hebrew, but you can also call it Eastern thinking, in a way, because there are still cultures and there are still people today that live, that have this different thing. And so I think it's also important to realize that, too, with different cultures and different people, that we're all not coming from the same spot, because, like, you know, Eastern cultures still have, like, you
for
know,
sure.
Like, Arab cultures still are really based in this, and, you know, the Chinese cultures are still really based in this. And so I think it helps us understand other people's point of views, too.
Definitely.
It's still out there.
Yeah, you know, for sure. Ways. For sure. All right. This is a QR code to my website in case you want it. There's some great articles on there. There's different opportunities for classes and coaching and different things. But
What's the name of the book?
It's called Who is Truth?
Is that the Thane and...
Yep, by Thane and Gant.
Does anyone here come across the Made Easier by David Reeves?
Oh, yeah.